Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this.
Nice beginning.
Take my way, that highway, that is the best. Two kicks out of Route 66. When I fly from Chicago to L.A., 42,000 miles along the way. Away, Joplin, Missouri, Oklahoma City, it sure looks pretty. You should see Amarillo, Dallas, New Mexico, Flagstaff, Arizona, darling, don't forget Madonna, even Marshall, San Bernardino,
and welcome to an Anto edition of Zuma Time. I'm your happy host, Dr. Mark here. Number to call to wine and dime me is 646-478-4847. And we are playing a little traveler music here to open the shoe, because tonight we're going to be going on a little cognitive journey as we cross the Soma Street and take a little look at the inside game of traffic with author Tom Vanderbilt as he brings his copious and heavy book to the air tonight. And we did an interview with him yesterday. Tom's down in Savannah, Georgia. And we really got a lot of information out of him, you know, that is between the lines in the book. Just a lot of things about what goes on in terms of the way that people understand traffic from a variety of angles. So anyway, that's going to be the main theme tonight. But first, once again, I need one of these, as I can put the sleep at the wheel, get your kicks on Route 66 to bed. Let me get this out of the way. Computer's acting up again. It's a constant theme here. But we need to have that sound. I really need that sound. I can't, let's see if I can play a sound. Maybe I'll just use the Batman one.
You filthy criminies.
Mm-hmm. As the swine friend now gets its endorsement from Obama. Yes, in the midst of the healthcare, there's the tweeters, the healthcare BS going on. Now, we are staring down the loaded gun of the CDC, and there is just, it's funny, they have a kind of a pattern of causing a lot of panic and then telling you not to panic. So, Obama urges Americans to get swine flu vaccine. Urges. Is it mandated to get? Is it made it all, you know, something that we have to all do or we'll run for Canada? But anyway, the global swine flu epidemic first emerged in April, sickening more than 1 million Americans and killing about 500. Now think about that. 500 died out of 1 million being sickened. Again, Wisconsin leading the charge. More than 2,000 people have died worldwide. 2,000 worldwide out of 6.5 billion. Hold on a minute. yeah. Uh-oh. This could be my... Is the cough?
All right, that's it. He's fired.
yeah.
Can I talk to you, Val?
No, yeah,
okay.
Please.
I'm back.
Anyway, vaccine development is ongoing and will be available by October. The president said the vaccine for the swine flu known as the H1N1 virus, which we're going to get into in depth. We have been talking about this all year. Seems like all summer we've been mentioning the swine friend. Next week, we're going to have a guest on to tear this thing a new a-hole. I'm sick of it, and I want to rid you of the fear of this BS. Maybe I'll get a little help from the law of attraction people. Maybe they'll take a break, and we'll woo this thing away. Anyway, it would be a voluntary thing for the vaccine, right? But he's strongly recommending it. Of course, certain groups are more vulnerable. Shut up, tweeters. Including children of two, pregnant women, and people with health problems, like asthma, diabetes, and heart disease. Well, that's like almost all of us. Like the seasonal flu, swine flu spreads through coughs and sneezes and things. You got to wash your hands, and it's terrible. This is the best thing. Wash your hands frequently and stay home. It's the best. Obama says, I know it sounds simple, but it's important, and it works. Tremendous. Now, of course, Governor Bloomberg, or Governor, what am I saying? Mayor Bloomberg, he thinks he's governor, is taking it to the next level, and he's has a whole strategy here that's coming under some review as the schools open. So his deal is a little more in-depth. Students get free vaccinations, health clinics turn into flu centers to relieve hospitals, emergency rooms, reporting on the web every day, and the schools only close as a last resort. Girding, I love that word, girding for a second wave of the swine flu pandemic, which has already killed, dead, more than 50 people in New York City. Mayor Bloomberg outlined a strategy Tuesday, equal parts infection control and panic control. I love the panic control part. It's natural to imagine a worst-case scenario, but all signs at this point in time do point to an outbreak that will be more than moderate. It is our job, era, to make sure that the city's government is fully prepared for whatever happens. I sound like Ted Kennedy. I'm channeling Ted Kennedy. Unbelievable. The closing of schools is the most contentious issue of the spring. Parents criticized the city for keeping schools open, even when large numbers of students were absent. And all around the country, this is going to be a big issue with the colleges going back and all that other stuff. And you got the state stuff, and you got paperwork problems. Oh, my God. What are they going to do? And it's just, it's hilarious because the vaccine, untested, we reported here a couple weeks ago, maybe. I think it was. Maybe it was last week. I don't know. Go back and listen to the archives. I don't listen to this dopey show. That the healthcare workers in Hong Kong were refusing to take the damn thing. 70% was satisfied with the city's response to the swine flu, according to the New York Times, back in the spring. And here we go again. School nurses will begin to assemble a database, and we're all going to buckle down. Unbelievable. This is amazing, because as I was discussing earlier with a sape of mine here in the office, if this came from the woo side of the tracks, not the conventional side, again, we've had David Goodman on the show a number of times, who established what was conventional, right? Center for Disease Control. There's no Center for Health. Yeah, we're having health reform. Anyway, they establish what's, you know, accepted, and we have to, and you have to sort of be a conscientious objector to this. So if they go the route of, as a matter of public safety, your kid can't go to a public school unless he has this H1N1 vaccine. And I'm telling you, you ain't getting my two kids nowhere, no how. So I don't know what you're doing. But he's trying to protect the, 12% of New Yorkers who report flu-like symptoms since mid-June. And the city identified 930 hospitalizations due to the swine flu and 54 deaths. And every year, the flu kills about 1,100 lucky New Yorkers. So, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it, and I'm sick of you. And I just, we're going to take a vitalistic approach. We're going to try and give you the information here on the Blog Talk Radio. Hopefully, I'm going to go on a couple other shows. Maybe I'll challenge some of these sapes, because they're premises of the germ being the agent of disease is a half-truth. Are germs carrying disease? No, actually not. They are opportunistic organisms, just like you and me, only they're smaller, microbes even. Which is why I recommend you go to giantmicrobes.com. They now have the swine flu little, this is funny. I can't, you can't make this up. This guy, Drew Oliver, I got to get this dude on the show. He has created a whole bunch of stuffed animals mimic the microbes that we're looking at and then chasing. So the swine flu is a little piggy, and there he is. He's, for $7.95, you can own the swine flu little giant microbes little doll. And there you go. I absolutely got to get this for somebody. Maybe I'll have them here in the office. I mean, they got all kinds. I mean, they got maladies like bad breath, athlete's foot. You got, you got E. coli. You can get the clap. You can get black death. Hey, how about flesh-eating bacteria and mad cow? This guy's got the best sellers include the common cold, the kissing disease, black death, as we mentioned, dust mites, bed bugs, and bookworms. Oh, my God. Educational and fun. So that's where we're at with that. I'm really at the point of no return when it comes to this stuff. I can't get enough vitriol out there because, you know.
You filthy criminies.
You keep exploiting us. And you keep beating us down, and you keep telling us what to think and how to act, and yet you want to revamp healthcare. Mm-hmm. Not on my watch. All right, so shifting gears to our guest tonight. Now, during the replay of the interview, I will be opening the chat room here on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And I will be sitting in the chat room listening along with you, hopefully. And if you have any questions, because this was an interview accomplished through hook and crook. It took many months. I'm in the chat room alone now. Oh, this is dark. And we got Tom on the air yesterday through the magic of Skype. And he sounds a little like he's, kind of deep sea fishing. And he's I don't know how clear it's going to be to you guys. We played it back. It seemed okay. I'm pretty clear. Not that my questions matter, but it's an interview that goes about 48 minutes. I will be one step away. If I get sick of it, I might stop it and then post the entire interview on blogsoma.net. But I'm going to let it ride, let it rip, and I'll be in the chat room. If you guys have any questions, comments, anything you want me to discuss when I emerge from the interview, almost at the top of the hour, I'll be happy to address the things then. And we'll close up the show, get ready for the preview next week. But for the most part, like I said, I want you to think about this stuff in the interview. We talked about it a little in the preview, is that the idea of the experience of driving or being a passenger even or being a non-driver is something that's so universal and has so many somatic lessons for us, from the neurological standpoint, from the perceptual standpoint, from the communication standpoint, from the societal standpoint. It's so many layers. I'm telling you, this book is it really is an encyclopedia of topics that you can just go off on so many different ways, so many different tangents, and really get a lot out of it. And I found it to be just a wealth of information. Tom did a unbelievable job putting this book together. I'm telling you, to tackle this thing is to get this book done. I mean, I'm trying to get my book done for the last, I don't know what, 5-6 years. If you're gonna be whining on here once a week, just trying to get you guys to understand the basics of somatics, which is compared to what this guy did is, I don't want to say it's a grain of sand, but my God. So anyway, sit back, relax, enjoy the interview, and I will be back to sum up the shoe once it's finished. Hopefully it'll play okay, won't have any glitches. I'll be manning the WAV files as this thing goes. Let's see if I can get... All right, stop. Anyway... Just trying anything here. So we're going to start the interview now, and we'll play it till it's over with. I'll come back, sum up. Again, I'll be in the chat room if you need me. I'm over there. And here he is, Tom Vanderbilt. First, we get to get the horn. Oh, let's get the horn. Get the horn, please, Flippy. There you go. All right. Here's Tom. Okay, and here we are in digital... some type of terrain with author Tom Vanderbilt, author of Traffic, and how you doing, Tom? You still there? Tom.
I am indeed. It's probably like I'm coming from Antarctica or something, but...
Yeah, you're definitely... Here. Where are you up? You're up in the Northeast? Where are you right now?
I'm actually in Savannah, Georgia at the moment.
Oh, wow, okay. All right, because Kate mentioned you're going to be in Boston next week. You're literally traveling with the book at this point, And what do you guys? I mean, the book has been out for a while. And it's one of those ones that you see on the stand and you go, why would anyone take the time to write a book like this? And I got to admit, it's a thick read in terms of there's a lot of information in it, but there's a lot of things that I came away from it just even reading it. And there's no way I could do a book report on the thing yet because there's so many things I have to kind of weigh through and really kind of drill down on some of the details. But did you find at the beginning of this project going into it that there was so much unknown, or was it something you really had to kind of like look under rocks to find this information? Because the amount of people you interviewed, spoke with, and reached out to is enormous. Was it something you thought was going to be kind of like, was all going to be ground apples, or did you really think you were going to have to get your shovel out and really dig for this stuff?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the things that actually got me launched on the book was I had a few different sorts of experiences in driving, and I started poking around the internet, and I sort of stumbled across. I mean, the information and the people are out there. You know, there are people who, for example, work in academia or highway departments or other things like that, who have incredibly specialized careers and studying things like interstate. Off-ramp configurations, things that we would think are very banal and sort of everyday, but actually turn out to be very complex sorts of environments and systems. So I just, trying to answer a few of these questions, I just felt like I was stumbling onto a real motherload of information that wasn't really that appreciated or known about by the public, even though, like I said, it was something that we're all involved in traffic in some capacity, even a person doesn't own a car. And it is an everyday environment. So, of course, I went out looking for a book that had been written, of course, and couldn't find anything that really matched what I was looking for that wasn't, you know, $120 traffic engineering textbook. So that sort of is how I got launched onto this strange pseudo-career, I guess you would call it.
Yeah, and again, the book is it's kind of a double entendre. The book's called Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do, and what it says about us, which gets you into this reflective mode. Some of the things we talk about a lot on the air here on Summertime a lot is there's a human element, like I said, a universal human element to driving that even as non-drivers, we appreciate because of the pedestrian factor. And you get into the how we've almost, in a way, overcompensated to try to make things safer for the pedestrians and in effect made it more dangerous for the drivers. Talk about how that paradox, you know, kind of rose up, because it's kind of in the middle of the book, middle third of the book, and it's one of those things that took me on a little bit of a detour, if you will, to use a little metaphors. There'll be a lot of metaphors here, and how people try to resolve that problem with the pedestrians.
Well, I mean, it's a funny thing. I'm in Savannah now, and Savannah, Georgia. It's one of the most quote unquote walkable cities in the U.S., and of course, it is very walkable. And they have had a bit of a pedestrian fatality problem here this year. There's been about 5 people killed on the roads, and they went on actually an anti-jaywalking blitz and started issuing tickets to people who were crossing against the light and such things. And, of course, one of the most high-profile cases was a Swedish diplomat, and as far as I could tell, he was killed while in the crosswalk. So this is something that I experienced yesterday. You know, it's one of these strange situations where you have a marked crosswalk where drivers are supposed to stop, and you find yourself at every intersection engaging in this bit of a sort of a game of almost chicken, but it's a little bit, you know, sort of a guessing game as to whether the person is going to stop, and sometimes you have to look for an actual and just boldly jump out and expect them to stop. But, I mean, this alone right here, the marked crosswalk idea, this is an incredibly controversial form of essentially pedestrian safety, and there's some speculation that it gives the pedestrian almost too much of a sense of confidence that we shouldn't trust someone like a driver to anticipate what we're going to do or to even to be willing to stop, which is often the case. And so, you know, we could talk for the next hour just about sort of pedestrian safety engineering and all this, but what I found, there's certain cases where things that have been put in over the years to ostensibly make things better for pedestrians were really sort of put in more almost for the convenience of drivers, and this may have been an unintended consequence, but for example, in London, there's a street called Kensington High Street, and it had all sorts of these pedestrian barricades that were put up to keep people from crossing anywhere but the crosswalk. So when they went about to make this street a better-looking place, they wanted to remodel it and get rid of a lot of the signage that had been put in over the years, and kind of this ugly iron works, and just make it a cleaner, nicer-looking place, and the short to make it long story short here, what they found is that by removing all these pedestrian barricades and almost encouraging people to cross wherever they wanted to, but doing so arguably in a more sort of vigilant manner, the pedestrian safety rate, indeed the entire traffic safety record for the entire street, has actually about these changes, none of which were approved by the official Department for Transport, which is the London people who run those things.
And this is another one where, again, all politics is local. It seems like all traffic perception is local. As a New Yorker, myself, I when I go to rural towns, I'm always amazed at how courteous everybody is, you know, waving people through, things like that. And you have a little story here about the traffic in Delhi, where the phrase is "good brakes, good horns, good luck." And from the outside, culturally, again, this is one of the things where Americans, I guess, are a little bit insulated in the sense, because other countries, you know, that the bicycles, all the other things that go on, the other side of the road aspect. I remember the whole thing with Matthew Broderick a million years ago, driving on the wrong side of the road kind of thing. You know, how much of driving, since it's a learned activity, everybody learns it, how much of it is connected to a reflection or a projection of culture, and how much is it is just common sense that which should be universal, like, you know, like more of a mathematical thing? Because there's a lot of analysis in here about traffic from a scientific standpoint, but it seems like it's an art to learn how to drive, and then there's a cultural wrinkle to it, depending on what city you're in or what part of the world you're in, where, you know, you could be driving in utter chaos in Delhi, or you could be driving in Miami and dealing with things, or New Jersey with those drug handles, which is another whole story. So how much did you find out in your research? What was the sort of the distribution of that? How much of the driving is more of a scientific, mathematical, logical thing, and how much of it is an art form in a way?
Well, it's a good question. I think in many places, you know, the engineers would like it to be a scientific activity, but I think the layer of culture always intervenes. And for example, in China, they've been building these incredible new modern freeway environments that look, you know, from the outside, they're quite well done. They're new. They can go very fast on them. So if you sort of squinted your eyes, you could imagine you're in California. But things are happening on those highways that are a little bit unusual. You find people doing things like stopping basically to urinate on the side of the road and just doing a lot of behavior that indicates a certain unfamiliarity with this high-speed highway environment, as if this is sort of a new thing. And people, it's almost a national learning curve at work in China, which is one of the reasons, of course, it has, I believe, the second highest annual road toll right now, right behind India. So, yeah, the same road, you know, roads are the material objects here, but what goes on those roads can be incredibly different from country to country, which is why I find variance in things like traffic fatality rates from a place like Netherlands to Belgium. And, you know, driving in Italy, of course, you'll find if you're in the left lane hanging out a little bit too slowly for someone's liking, they will aggressive rear bumper and begin flashing their headlights and engaging in much ruder, you know, sort of aggressive behavior that we see some of that in the U.S., but in the U.S., I think we're still more concerned with individual rights. And arguably, Italy is more of sort of a, you know, might equals right, fend for yourself sort of activity going on out there. So,
yeah, like I said, there's a complete culture shock sometimes when you travel and you realize that you're not in Kansas anymore, literally, and you have to adapt and sort of drive like the natives, otherwise you get swept away with it. You know, one story you gave in there about the stop signs is that a lot of times people spend so much time and energy. You know, I remember the sort of yellow neon fire trucks for a while were driving around here in Larchmont, and people would get into accidents because they literally would not see the fire truck, you know, that kind of a thing. And you talk about the fact that it's more the placement of the sign, like we have almost a code of where we expect signs to be as a driver, so we're not really reading the stop sign so much as we're looking in that part of the visual space that if there's going to be a sign, we'll see it over there. We look twice, as you say, and for the most part, we're driving blind. Which is kind of a scary fact, but it's another one of these things. The physiology of driving, as again a composite skill we learn, that gets into these perceptual limits of both the driver and other drivers, and of course the way that people design these roads. So talk a little bit about perception as it relates to driving? Because, and then I want to get into some of the things about your research that surprised you as you uncovered some of these things that people just assume is reality when it actually isn't, like this thing about the stop signs. So just talk a little about perceptual limits and how that affects our driving experience personally and collectively. It's a really great part of the book.
Yeah, this was something that was really eye-opening to me. I guess that's a bad pun there. But, you know, we tend to equate vision in driving with something, you know, like going down to the DMV to stare at that little row of descending letters. And if you could make out the last row, okay, you could see the road, you're a good driver. But that really explains a small part of it, which is what we see on the road. But then there's the idea of what we actually perceive on the road. And, of course, perception and vision are not always linked up 100%. And the study you're alluding to with stop signs is sort of a very humorous one to me, where the lettering was actually manipulated and the stop sign no longer saw. And of course, no one saw it because I guess this is what they might call top-down processing. We sort of know to expect stop signs at intersections. And so something that's bottom-up is unexpected, and that would be the hazard we're not looking for. And those are the sorts of scary things that you get. But, you know, so we have cognitive illusions have been identified famously by psychologist named Daniel Simons. One of these is attention blindness, which is the idea that it's easy to miss something that you're not looking for. And I had this knock on the street looking for a parking space. And when you have sort of a visual search pattern on for a parking space, being a scarce commodity in New York City, I almost basically went through a red light because I was so intent on finding this parking space that had kind of overtaken my entire sort of frame of mental processing. And this, of course, is a major reason why red lights are a hazard. You're people approaching intersections at high speeds, and you're asking them to be able to pick out this sort of light dangling in the sky when they might have a lot of other things on their mind. Of course, you also have people accelerating toward the very intersection to not catch the red light. And, you know, this is in some ways a recipe for disaster, which is why in many places we're switching to roundabout intersections where possible, which, you know, it is a bit harder to miss a roundabout when, you know, it's sort of especially when there's an object in the middle of it. But again, this really was quite novel to me to think about driving in this way. And it sort of made me wonder why the road safety situation isn't actually worse than it is. Mm-hmm. Not that it's not a major public health issue, and how I've gotten through life relatively unscathed.
Yeah, like I said, when if you read even 50 pages of this book, you start a lot of things, and these are, again, part of the global experience of it, that it's a universal thing to deal with traffic and to become a driver, so to speak, and that's why, you know, when you sort of even get ankle deep in this material, it is sort of another mode we go into, and it becomes sort of second nature after a while. And you talk about the flow and the era of, lack of a better word, Sunday drive kind of a thing seems to be gone. Everybody has an agenda when they're driving now, with GPSs and things like that. It's become sort of video game-ish. I mean, you don't really have that visceral sense until something happens. Like you said, when people have an emergency, it becomes more of a bottom-up and more, you know, kind of a body-to-brain experience. And again, your research kind of tackles a lot of these kind of core assumptions people have about driving that get into, you know, to me, would be a good part of a driver's education rather than going by the bromides that people walk around in their heads thinking that this is the case, and then they get out on the road and there's a whole difference between the way they train us to drive and then our experience to drive. So give us, like, maybe your top five working assumptions that people would have about, you know, about driving or about traffic in general that your evidence that your research contradicts.
Well, and some of the things that occurred to me, and I don't know if this actually does jive with everyone, but you know, I went into this as just basically a civilian, just an average sort of driver / pedestrian / cyclist. And, you know, I carried around those sort of and thoughts about how the world must work out there. One thing, for example, is just this idea of risk and where risk is actually located, where the risk is coming from. And I should first say that, you know, risk is something that we tend to misperceive quite readily as humans. I mean, psychologists have found rather famously that, you know, we tend to attribute we tend to react more strongly to risks that are, for example, novel and out of our control. So something like, 9/11, this idea of sort of terrorists from abroad coming in. This was a new thing that had never been done, and involuntary risk. I mean, this is sort of off the charts. On the other hand, you have something like mountain climbing. This is very voluntary risk, people, self-selecting group doing this. In any case, to get back to traffic, for example, there's a lot of stuff in the media, in my opinion, before I went into the book, about large trucks and how these are very dangerous, and you hear things in the news about truckers being on drugs and trying to stay up all night, and trucks from Mexico coming in because of NAFTA. And the reality is, when people who really sort of broke down all the data when crashes did happen, is that drivers of cars were responsible for a majority of the crashes. So, it's not necessarily to implicate drivers, but it just points to this, what you mentioned about education, something we're not taught when we are taught to drive a car. We don't spend time inside of a truck. We don't understand how a truck performs in relation to a car. We don't understand what the driver of a truck is seeing. So there's sort of a disconnect there between, what a car driver's expectation is versus a truck driver. And you basically find people doing a lot of irresponsible things in the presence of these large trucks. And obviously, because of the size mismatch, that's only going to turn out one way when it happens. So, I would be interested if that become, and this has actually been suggested, for that to become part of the driving curriculum. If you're going to put large trucks and cars on the same roads, that people should have some knowledge of that other mode. And you could even extrapolate this to, if you're going to have bikes on the road, then, and this, I think, explains a lot of the hostility we see between some car drivers and cyclists. A lot of those car drivers have never been on a bike. They aren't cyclists as well. They don't understand what's going on. And there's just sort of almost a fundamental disconnect there between people, two different modes sharing the same road.
Yeah, and again, there's another cultural divide. Like, again, New York City has the template here with the messengers on the bikes weaving in and out of traffic and the cabs doing the same thing. And then you have the commuters that are dealing with, even some things like you talk about 9/11, when they go into these safety modes where they close certain bridges and it just seems like we're sort of in a, like, I don't say rat in a maze in a little bit, but there's only so much influence we have over the conditions that we're driving in, and as you say, that there's a lot of cross-cultural embedded stuff going on here, and that gets into some of the other stuff you talk about, the nonverbal part of driving, which is the eye contact part. Again, you're dealing with high speeds, you're dealing with a lot of things that are happening almost at an imperceptible rate. So, some of the stuff you discuss here about when dangerous roads are safer, which is a great chapter title. That should be like a little movie they show people. And it's like what we're dealing with a lot, especially when the city driver goes to the country, when the country driver comes to the city, how do you get past somebody's driving history when someone's used to a certain rhythm and they're blending in with everybody else? I mean, this weekend coming up here with Labor Day, you're going to have a lot of people from out of town that don't have easy pass, so to speak, getting over the bridges in New York. And they have to – you're dealing a lot with this whole idea of merging. And the book opens up with the ultimate conundrum. Are you a late merger or an early merger? And, again, this is another contradiction. Everyone would assume the early mergers are the good fish that get in line when the lane's going to end, or we have to get over to get the cash lane or whatever, and everyone just kind of falls in line and follows suit. But the research shows the opposite, that the late mergers actually optimize the traffic flow because of some engineering things that you wouldn't think of the factor, but it's actually more of an individual kind of a personality test that you either pass or fail, and you converted. And talk about that aspect of it where you started out you started out as a late merger, became an early one, then went back to late. How'd that work? Because it's one of the things around here in the tri-state area that's conflict coming up because people don't let you in, and that actually makes more congestion. So just discuss that psychology of eye contact and merging and about how people deal with this sort of almost like an interpersonal kind of personality test that we're out there on the roads experiencing all the time, especially with a holiday coming up.
Yeah, well, it seems like a minor thing, but this is sort of, I thought that this contained so much richness, really, to think about. It was one of these situations where you're driving along It was the New Jersey highway, New Jersey, and there were two lanes that had to go down into one because of construction. So you had, you know, sort of a sign that was put up that was quite vague. It's a right 1 mile. It didn't, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean merge right now, merge in 1 mile, merge somewhere along the next mile? And, you know, the problem, you know, when there's no traffic at all, this is, you know, barely a problem because people have all sorts of opportunities to merge, and it's not really an issue. But once you start to get heavy congestion, you see these patterns emerge of where the lane that is going to remain open quickly becomes sort of filled with all these people like my former self jumping over to this lane that's a polite thing to do, and you sort of just don't know, and you might be worried about not being let back in, as you mentioned. And
right.
So, yeah, I one day I became one of these late mergers and sort of jumped all the way to the front and really felt a little bit guilty about it and could sense the hostile glares of other drivers. But at the other hand, I was thinking, well, you know, why are we forming this immensely long queue going all the way back when there is all this sort of empty space? And is it really better if every driver got over as soon as possible, or could there be a better way? So that's when I started looking into these traffic engineering tomes and texts, and found that there were some interesting research that had been done that you had these sort of dynamic late merge systems where you urge the drivers to go to the end and then do a one-on-one zipper merge would actually move more cars through that bottleneck.
Yeah, these spot roads that give you the blinking lights to say to vary the speed zone.
Variables there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about that in Europe where they have the smart roads will actually modulate the speed limits to keep the traffic flowing, which is another way of doing it. And then there's a guy in the book, I forget his name off the top of my head, he decided to just travel at 35 miles an hour to see what would happen. He didn't go up or down, and people kind of spaced out behind him, which is another way, kind of like another entraining that goes on within the experience of driving that's unique to. Again, this is what to me. It's in reading the book. There's a definite science to it because there's enough engineering going on. There's enough analysis going on, but there's a definite aspect of it being an art form, and everyone gets to sort of get the paintbrush every time they get behind the wheel and sort of, you know, influence other people. Go ahead,
Mark. Sorry, I'm sorry. You're going out quite a bit.
Oh, can you hear me there?
The same is happening with me.
No, I just didn't hear you the last question. That's all. I just, if you've been trying to talk for the last 30 seconds, it was me talking. So if you didn't hear me, I'll just repeat the question.
No, for about 5 seconds, I couldn't hear you, and I don't know if you're not able to hear me for a long time.
Well, no. We heard your last answer, and then I just started talking again. So I'll just pick it up from there. I was just saying how, despite the analysis that you give here, especially about the roads in Europe where they'll actually vary the speed limits to kind of modulate the traffic a little bit, and the other experiment where you talked about the guy that just drove 35 miles an hour to kind of put everybody at a certain distance, it just seems like there's a lot of artistic license, if you will, that people could do to influence their driving experience if they would just experiment a little with these things. And again, this is what the nuance is about it. That I'm really interested in is how are people applying all this psychology to the getting back into the human factor as the technology keeps expanding? Because it just seems like if we rely on things like the GPS, if we rely on things you know that are more external to us, it seems like we're sort of giving into a kind of a smoothed out curve where driving is much more of a granular experience. So how are people kind of balance those two things between the technical world we're immersed in and the low-tech world that we're actually experiencing when we're driving?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, to actually improve traffic behavior out there in driving, this is almost a no-brainer. It would be better if a human were taken entirely away from the wheel. I mean, we as a species, we are sometimes willing to cooperate, and some people argue we have a certain altruism built in, but there are certain conditions about traffic that make that cooperation and altruism difficult. And just to mention a couple, one is the eye contact that you referred to earlier. We're missing
mm-hmm.
eye contact, and this is found in various experiments to be an important thing that we use as sort of a social glue to get, and it's been argued that that's why we have the amount of white sclera in our eyes that we do, so people can see where we're looking and we can see where they're looking and what we want them to do, what our intentions are. So we get a lot of information from people's eyes, and that's just one of the things we're missing out there on the road, forms of communication. Another thing is basically in traffic, you know, it's an anonymous system and there's not much feedback. And so how do you punish behavior? This, a lot of people involve a collective pool of money. And let's imagine, you know, sort of good driving behavior as this collective pool. Well, if someone sort of violates that and cheats from it, how are you going to punish them? Well, in these experimental games, the people are able to punish them in the next round by, you know, through a mechanism in the game. But in traffic, you know, there really is no next round. You don't see the person who wronged you yesterday. You don't see them tomorrow, unless you live in a very small town. So there's just a sort of anonymity built into the world of traffic that, again, owns this willingness to cooperate. So, you know, arguably, we're taking the human factor out of driving. Not only will we make it more pleasant experience as a system, but there's things about the dynamics of driving that we're necessarily the best at that actually arguably contribute to traffic congestion. The example I want to mention here is a video that you can look on, see on YouTube. A group of Japanese researchers got a closed track of vehicles, and there were no bottlenecks, no crashes, no new cars coming on. They had about 10 cars in a circle and asked them to drive in a steady circle, keep the same speed, keep the same following distance, and machines, though, and they have trouble maintaining that exact same distance and speed. As these little gaps and differences between that are not sort of built up over time into actual stop and go congestion, just these minor differences because of these nonlinear dynamics of traffic sort of backwards across the vehicles further back, and it's just amazing to watch. But so again, just these little human imperfections in a way lead to these larger problems. I'm not arguing that all traffic congestion is somehow a form of just foibles, but it's one of these very minor things that, you know, sort of enters into it.
Yeah, there's an old book on my shelf called Turtles, Termites, and Traffic Jams by Resnick that talks about the decentralization. Great book. And about, again, this gets into, you mentioned a buzzword there, nonlinear dynamics, which is the listeners of the show know I go, I'm cuckoo for chaos, kind of a speak. And the nonlinear aspects of our nervous systems, to be able to, again, you get into the idea that multitasking, not a good idea to do in a car, not very efficient, and the phenomenon now of, and again, what's more unsafe or more likely, drunk driving versus driving while texting, which I've seen people do so many things, eating while driving, that makes things clumsy, but the texting thing absolutely terrifies me. And how do you regulate something that is so pervasive in the culture and is so impossible to sort of legislate when everybody basically is hooked into this digital world 24/7, even while they're driving? I find that if people, I panic when someone sends something to me on Twitter or Facebook that says that they're driving and no, don't do this now. How do you get the feedback? Again, this anonymity part of it, this sort of systemic irresponsibility we have. I posted a video about it I think it was Australia came out with a public service video watching these three teenage girls have a major car accident and to demonstrate that texting while driving is just a terrible thing. Well, how do we get past that? How do we? Because 20, 30 years of the drunk driving deterrence haven't really worked. How do we get the digital world out of the driving world, or do we?
From Wales, and of course, the New York Times today had an article interestingly looking at, you know, do these sorts of campaigns work, and arguably they don't. Well, they don't work in isolation. This gets back to a cliche in the world of traffic safety, which is the three E's: education, enforcement, and engineering. So you argue that drunk driving has not been curbed, but, you know, of course, in fact, it has, and it's obviously still a major public health issue, and one might argue that it is also unenforceable. Of course, we have found ways to enforce it, and one of those ways now is through engineering, by having ignition in the vehicles of chronic offenders. And if you don't, you know, if your breath is not,
yeah, the car will start
blow, blow into it. You, exactly. So we need to, you know, there's no reason why we can't have a sort of Bluetooth. And this stuff is already on the market, of course, devices that would phone or wireless devices in motion and would prevent it from working, or would send a special message saying I'm driving, or would read you, at least read you the text over the audio channel of the radio, which is a much smaller distraction. So I think it's going to take, it really is going to take the classic triumvirate here of these three E's. You know, the enforcement right now is a bit of a joke, I have to say. It's a $20 fine in many states, even if you have someone while you're doing it. So the education is also coming up, and the engineering is there as well. So, but, you know, we're going to need all three. But it gets down to behavioral change as well, and there are things we might have looked at, you know, if you consider the public health hazard of smoking. This is something that a couple decades ago, if you said, you know, we're going to ban smoking in all public spaces, people have said, oh, you're nuts, that'll never happen. And of course, you go to a bar now, and I can't remember the last time I heard someone lament the lack of smoke in a bar. It's just something that has become the norm, you know, almost overnight. I think we've adjusted to it, you know, with a few holdouts.
Yeah, again, this is, again, controlling the driving behaviors. Even something as simple as the campaign against drowsy drivers is another issue that, especially around here, people coming off the thruway, driving late at night, you're dealing with, well, now you've got to control how awake somebody is, which means they're going to be taking some form of pharmaceutical or otherwise to stay awake. So how do you, again, we're dealing with a 24/7 culture that's constantly commuting and transporting and things like that. How do you get to the point where the person is getting behind the wheel, fully aware of all the, the variables, I guess is the medical word, that would influence their driving experience when only a few of them might actually surface in the course of one driving event? It seems like we're in a spiral of contingency thinking, of what-if thinking, and the what-is part seems to be past pace instead of future pace. It seems to be result-oriented from what happened here, what happened there. And like you said, predicting driving is sort of like predicting weather. We had the bridge go out here in the city over here, and the Throgsnag Bridge was out for about 6-7 weeks. And it caused, people were still driving into the same patterns 6-7 weeks later, thinking that the bridge magically was going to work. And it was like every day there was traffic jams. How do you get people informed beyond the superficial so that they can actually fundamentally change the way that they behave behind the wheel? Is it possible? Tom?
I missed the last part of that.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just saying, if given all these factors, how do we fundamentally change the way that human beings behave behind the wheel, given that if you take 100 variables, maybe 3 or 4 of them will be at play in a giving driving event, people can't keep that much in their head. It's like if they know that all these things are causing risk factors to rise, or their pace of their driving behind other cars, and all the things, that all the kind of the mental blind spots that we travel around with, you can't get it through just public service and deterrence and scare tactics. And you talk about that semi-conscious fear we're all driving. Everyone says drive safe, you know. How do you get people past that point where they can actually fundamentally shift and as a culture or even just as personally, so that they're optimizing that experience rather than trying to kind of weave between the holes in the system? Because it just sounds like there's a tremendous amount of holes on all three of those things, education and engineering and being able to be, you know, competent behind the wheel. Is it, you know, whether you're dealing with elderly drivers, teenage drivers, commuters, there's so many sub-communities that seem to be all kind of just driving along with a lot of blank spots. So what's the overarching thing you found in all your research
you're never going to entirely eliminate all risk from driving. I've seen studies that look at everything from people who had a professional soccer game on the. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't hear that. Well, no, it's a really good question, and it gets back to the idea of if we're ever going to eliminate all risk from driving, there's any number of potential risk factors out there. And at the end of the day, humans are humans. We're not infallible decision makers. We don't have infallible perceptual systems. I was in an automated car in New York City, a fully autonomous vehicle. I drove it down 11th Avenue, but rather it drove me. Perfect sort of LIDAR system, 360. It detected every hazard. It could respond to every hazard in time. It never got tired. It, you know, of course, it might have a computer bug or something. So, you know, so that's where we have to rely on other. It's always a multi-pronged approach. That's where you need something like engineering. Yes, some roads can be built to make drivers feel safer, and that will cause them to take more risks. But at the end of the day, if it's still a safer road generally, you know, it's sort of okay. But there's other things you can do that are very passive systems that actually don't really increase your sense of security, but will actually help keep you something, you know, the grumble along the side of a road. I mean, this is something that was only introduced on the Pennsylvania Turnpike over a decade ago, and you immediately saw a reduction in these instances where people were falling asleep and running off the road, because this is a passive little feedback system that gives you a jolt and essentially wakes you up. And now this doesn't actually cause people to drive more risky. They don't think, oh, if I fall asleep, the rumble strips will help keep me alive. But it's something that's very subtle, but is a minor intervention that can be done to help, you know, sort of forgive the mistakes that some drivers will make. So, you know, I'm all for the personal responsibility side and making driving a more restrictive task that fewer people should be allowed to do, I think. But you know, but again, no one approach is going to solve any of these issues. It's really complex on a number of levels.
Yeah, it just seems like the education has always been more third person and you know, outside and you know, more about the things that are going to be enforced. And some, like, people know locally, you go through this yellow light, you're cool. You go through another yellow light, you got a camera there. People learn sort of ways around the system like they do in any other form of public space kind of a thing. I just find it fascinating how personality comes into play and culture comes into play, and if you're a risk taker or not comes into play. And it's just, to me, it's just the material you sort of exposed is an underbelly of the way the culture at large is working. So, and traffic, I said, it's a metaphor because traffic's no good on the ground, but it's great on the websites. You know, it's like there's a lot of things about that whole process of interacting with a you know, this sort of nonlinear space, as you talk about, that calls in a lot of variables that, like I said, you can't control them all. But what you can really get out of the book, and I hope people understand this, you know, through the magic of Skype here, we're talking to Tom, is that there's a lot of layers of the communication that go on that are not apparent at the first glance because of the fact that we have these perceptual limitations. And if you just know that, and they teach you about the blind spot with parking and things like that. Like yesterday I was involved in unfortunately, I guess you can look at it one way or the other, I was in a funeral procession. I wasn't in the first, so I guess I'm lucky, but I was in one, so I guess I was a little unlucky. So, and the lack of awareness of the funeral procession, you know, I was the last car, by the other drivers as we came through intersections. They'd let everybody else go, and then I'd have to sneak around. I found it a little off-putting that, wait a minute, you know, doesn't everyone respect this slow-moving bunch of cars that I happen to be around? And those kinds of things, like parades and, you know, these things that cause gridlock, and I'm always fascinated how the beginning and the end of those chains seem to have a whole different social context than the middle just gets kind of bypassed in. And when we're driving, like you said, there's much more of an other than conscious kind of second nature that goes on that causes those perceptual filters to be sort of an automatic pilot, unless something, like you said, bottom up that comes up to surprise us. And all the things you're talking about digitally that we're doing to enhance that or fill in some of those gaps are starting to catch up. But that middle layer of enforcement, which is either going to be through cameras or helicopters or things like this, or through, you know, the local law enforcement, it just seems like there's another one of those art form things where they can put all the science they wanted to, they can analyze it all they want, but there's hearts beating behind these wheels that are pumping, that are distracted and doing things, and there's emotional factors as well. So what advice can you give people going into the long weekend here as they go out on the roads, and some of them are just doing a lot of local driving, staycation kind of stuff, that can make them a little bit more alert, a little bit more aware as they're driving around.
Well,
go ahead. Uh-oh. We're in one of those lulls. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Yeah, it's quite ironic to me that you mentioned funeral processions, because this is something that and shows, again, the complexity and variance of crossing last week, in fact, crossing New York, walking into Prospect Park, and I had the walk signal. So, of course, I started on my way.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, a car comes sort of barreling at me. And this is my expectation. It was completely confounded, and I was almost struck and probably killed by this car. And, of course, the irony here is that it was a funeral procession. And this is a strange thing where, you know, my mind was so locked onto this idea that it was my turn to cross, and I didn't need to look at what was coming. Of course, I wonder about the legality of this funeral procession. They had sort of, a few of them had placards in the windows, but there wasn't really a police escort, or there weren't lights flashing on all the cars. So, and this made me wonder, I went into this whole reverie about funeral processions and whether they sort of predated the automobile culture, or going back to some kind of horse-drawn, you know, New Orleans kind of jazz funeral in the street, and is something like a funeral procession in modern, you know, complicated traffic, should we even be doing these things? And what, you know, there's sort of an honor thing going on there, and a respect thing. And you see this with a lot of examples, like the roadside memorials. This is something people want to, pay homage to someone who was killed in traffic, yet the DOT says, well, you shouldn't put those up because, you know, you're going to distract people more. So there's all these layers interacting, the legal layers, the cultural layers. And so I guess just to close what we should do in the upcoming weekend, and this is just this idea that we have these mental models out there of what's happening in traffic, and we all have them. This is some of the most interesting stuff I came across in the book, was people who, you know, studying things such as a guy named Ian Walker in England who rode a bike outfitted with a special sensor, how close a car had passed, and when he wore a helmet, cars actually passed closer to him than when he didn't have the helmet on. So this is kind of this, again, this nonverbal communication going on that you mentioned. You know, we sort of make these assumptions about people, you know, based on a number of factors we might not even be that aware of, and one person's mental model may not match up with what the other person is doing, and this could cause trouble. So again, the only lesson is just it's never as simple as you think it is, the traffic environment. I mean, we learn to drive at age 16 and we almost stop thinking about it as an activity, but I would argue it's you know, incredibly rich on a number of levels and challenging and all that.
Yeah, I think it's like I said, there's a lot to be said for that driver's ed anxiety coming back over people, especially going out this weekend into the cultural migration that's going to be going on around here. So just to wrap things up, there's a lot of stuff in that book. Like I said, people can read this book. It's a great book, and I hope people are reading it while they're on planes, actually. I mean, I said in the airports, because it's out in paperback now. You could definitely check it out on a, you know, East Coast, West Coast flight. It's a big, thick book here. What's the number one? It would be a long flight book, I think. What would be the number one misconception about traffic that people have that you can clear up now for the Blog Talk Radio audience, so that even if they don't get a chance to catch your book, they can know this before they head out this weekend?
I'm sorry, I think you asked.
We want to know the number one misconception about traffic that people can get to know right now before they pick up your book, so that they can walk out this weekend knowing that they can clear that up about stuff that you've been researching, the number one misconception they might have about traffic that you can rid them of right now.
Well, if I understood your question through the digital garble transmission there, I think one thing that struck me is that this disconnect between traffic, how it functions as a system, and how the individual driver wants to function themselves. And so, for example, you look at a sort of a crowded highway and you think, well, if we could just get people going faster, this would all be better for the system. It would be higher, what engineers call throughput. And it struck me that engineers found that highways actually perform best at a speed around 55 miles an hour rather than 75. But, you know, as you get to those higher speeds, you have to introduce more distance between cars for stopping distance. That sort of pushes people apart. And then, again, you get these overreactions from people that understand someone's braking. Are they really braking? Are they just tapping on the higher speeds? And there's less time to react to other people's decisions. So the slower speeds, in a way, can actually be faster in sort of a larger sense, from a systemic sense. And I found this a lot in traffic, that sometimes people's conception of what is fast and what is slow is sometimes confounded. You see this with roundabouts, for example. People are doing well. You know, you have to slow down to go through them. There's a chain of these roundabouts that's going to make my trip faster. It's making traffic worse. But when actually time the journey, sometimes the traffic, the trip is actually decreased in time, but the perception of that trip is that it's become slower. And this is another thing that traffic really plays with in our minds, is our sense of time. And I think this does contribute to a lot of the bad driving out there. So,
all right, well, like I said, there's so much to take away from this book. I didn't get into things like hypnosis and some other aspects, but hopefully, you know, if we get a lot of reaction out of the show, maybe we'll get you on when you get off the road, and we could deal with the callers live and have a little retrospective here, because there's a lot of stuff to digest. And like I said, I think your material is fascinating. As far as the somatic perspective, driving is the ultimate somatic education. I have clients out there that spend seemingly endless hours test driving cars to make sure they don't hurt their backs and stuff like that. The ergonomics of driving is another whole topic. So, like you said, there's an encyclopedia of topics that could come out of this one subject of traffic that is just, it's in your life, whether you're driving or not, whether you're a passenger, whether you're a commuter. There's so much like that affects people's lives, quality of people's lives, actually. And I thank you for putting this book together for people to get started on this this education, because you know, the rest of the system is working on different aspects of it. So we can get inside the way the driver's wiring is affecting people, and just add to the safety just a little bit more. It's a great service for people. And thanks for taking the time to get to the Skype and wash through the ethers and get some of this out. And hopefully we'll get to chatting on it, and we'll get you back on soon to clarify some things as they come up. But hold on one sec while we get out of the digital waters, and I'll be right back. For the rest of you, just keep listening here to Somatime. And welcome back to the live version of Filippi. Ooh, the chat room was a buzz with a bunch of guests that didn't want to type to me. I don't know. A lot of things flipping around on the Twitter. A lot of things happening on the old Facebook. Boy, I need to have a tutorial to get you guys to do multitasking with me here on the Block Talk dealio. Wow, that was an exercise. Hopefully you enjoyed the interview again. Listen back to it. I probably will post it solamente as a WAV file on the blog Soma.net, just to spare everybody all the particulars of before and after. Just want to listen to Tom. I don't know. Maybe I'll do that. You know what? I get paid for this. Anyway. taking a look at the bed ball. The Crankies are up, I believe it was, no, now it's 6-2 in the ninth inning. They can't get this last out, these damn Orioles. So the Yankees are going to win, I think, their 11th in a row over the O's. Yeah, 6-2, two outs, and looks like Cano's up or somebody. I can't even look at it. Yankees are they're going to be very annoying this year. They're going to be a tough out. I hope they have a nice flat week in October so we can just have a nice elimination day. Elimination day out here. Meanwhile, the Mutts are mucking along out there in Denver. Shangri-La, otherwise known as Shangri-La. Fifth inning, 2-2, two outs for the Rockies, guy in first. Again, the Giants beat the Phillies today, as we recap all the scores. We give you the scores here in Summertime. So, Rockies have to win to stay ahead in the wild card race. So that's kind of important. And let's see. Tampa's beating Boston 5-4. We got Florida beating Atlanta 7-6. Lots going on out there in baseball land. So, you know, as we get heated up with the pennant races, maybe we'll jump over to Mike Silva's New York Baseball Digest. I have a little post to write about Mr. Pelfrey and his Onto Brain that I'll be slapping up there at some point in the next 36 hours as the moon flows. Oh, look at this. The Mets just threw out a guy at the plate. You know, I saw a stat the other day that Raises Shines and Eco, the Mets third base coach, has gotten 16 guys thrown out at home this year. I can almost remember all of them. I mean, most of them are out by 10 feet. So we just threw out a guy at the plate, which is rare. I don't even get excited, though. You know, I'm so football-bound right now. Going to see Big Fan on Friday in White Plains. A fabulous movie about an obsessed Giant fan. I'm telling you, if I would have known they were, you know, offering people the reef of the part, I'd have been there. How about that? Beltran goes 1-for-3 in his rehab start in Brooklyn, if you were down there tonight. So there you go, a little recap of the sports. And, again, to sum up the interview with Tom there, a lot of the stuff he's talking about is very parallel to what we talk about in somatics in terms of first-person awareness, things like that, and vision science and all the perceptual filters that go on. And, you know, this show is called Beyond the BS, Beyond the Belief System. We're trying to get you past the superficial layer, get you to work a little deeper. And everything he was mentioning there, you know, it's so, those three E's about education, enforcement, and engineering, getting you out of that third-person science paradigm is really the only thing I can offer you. It is the one and only gift I have is to get you back to your roots, your biological roots. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to somaspace.org. Click on Meet the Four Domains and go read the free ebook, freaking free ebook, called The S-List, which gives you a lot of, golden lessons about how to interact with yourself and others. Read about the domains. We talk about it a lot. We're going to talk about it more next week in detail because the show is going to be more soma-specific as we get into this damn swine flu. So I went over to Wikipedia while I was doing nothing and wanted to give you guys a little profile on the old swine flu. On the old swine flu. All right, so basically this 2009 pandemic is four different flus. It's like one of those four cheese pizzas. It's the North American Mexican influenza, the North American avian influenza, human influenza, and swine influenza, found typically in Asia and Europe. And unusually, well, this is great, an unusually mongrelized mix of genetic sequences. Mongrelized? Again, if the WHO is saying this, there's a fourfold virus that's coming to get you. People would think we're nuts, but they got little diagrams of birds and pigs on the Wikipedia page. Unbelievable. This new strain appears to be a result of resortment of human influenza and swine influenza viruses in all four strains of subtype H1N1. Preliminary genetic characterization found that hemagglutinin HA gene was similar to that of the swine flu present in the U.S. pigs since 1999. But the neuroiamidase and the matrix protein, hello Bartlett, resembled versions present in the European swine isolates. The six genes from American swine flu are themselves a mixture of swine flu, bird flu, and human flu. Lots of flu! While viruses with this genetic makeup had not previously been found circulating in humans or pigs, there is no formal national surveillance system to determine what viruses are circulating in pigs in the good old USA. That's right. We like our bacon. Oh, wow. Good play at first base. I don't even know if he was out, though, but the ump enjoyed himself. Tula Whiskey with a gun. On June 11th, 2009, the WHO, who are you, declared the H1N1 pandemic, moving the alert level to phase 6, marking the first global pandemic since the 1968 Hong Kong flu. Hong Kong Fui. So there you go. That's what this dopey thing is all about. I really hope that we get enough people on next week, talk about if they're going to get their kids a little shot, things like that, so we can get a little vitalistic on you, yes, and get you educated. Because this stuff, I'm telling you, is part of a bigger picture that basically is, you know, we've talked about it from a variety of angles all summer. We had Rushkoff on talking about how the corporatism took over and all the things that go on interpersonally with the way that we see each other. When you think that the invisible bug is there, and vaccinations is just another layer of this, all right? Next week's guest, Michael Lowes, is out from Phoenix, another friend of the family. So so to speak, as our Arizona guest list keeps expanding. He's akin. He came through our pain guy from a couple of weeks ago out there, and it's amazing. I have at this point. I feel like I need to have the show relocate to the West Coast in a way, because we get so many guests from Arizona. I have to make almost like a mental list of this at this point. Let me just take a little quick peek here, since nobody can control me. I can go look something up, and you can't stop me. All right, going down the summertime guest list. Yeah, so we had Dr. Petrus on back on August 12th. He's a pain guy. We had Samuel Linder Groves Bunder. They were Californian. Of course, David Goodman, Californian. Arlene Taylor, Californian. Craig Martin, Californian. Yeah. Dave Lacani, he was Idahoan. Robert Affolter, Washington State. Starting to think this is a trend, at least since July 1st. Wow, lots of them. I think Al and Marilyn Sargent are also Californian. Sung Lee was Arizona. This is nuts. When I look at this, it's like, yeah, you go few and far between for the East Coast guests. I got all these West Coast guests and an East Coast time zone. Very strange. Anyway, what's the difference? So this guy, I'm talking to myself. So Michael Ross is going to be on. We're talking about the healing response. And he says, this is what your body does. Again, a lot of the vitalistic stuff is so plain and so self-evident that we take it for granted. But he gets into the fact that what your body's capable of doing at any given point in time, it's its best effort to adapt to its surroundings. Okay, and then he talks about the energetic you, which gets into vitality, and those aspects of you that can get beyond words and conscious thought. Okay, we get a little woo, gets into the spiritual and the soul. Now, he's a PhD. He gets to talk about the spiritual stuff. Some saints like me don't, but we keep it all physiologically and, you know, kind of like that there. So he's going to go through all these principles that talk about the host. Remember, there's a germ and there's a host, and you can't let a little microbe run your head. All right? These things do not proliferate without an environment to support them. Neither do we. Clusters of cells we are. So we're going to get into that whole nitty-gritty next week. He's got about, 10 principles here, 11 principles here, and a bunch of sort of like, you know, natural laws that kind of go back over this stuff. So he talks about things like aging and toxins and the environment, gene expression, really hardcore stuff. The brain provides one level, but not the only level. You know, intelligence, we talk about that. Living in the rhythm, he talks about diurnal and lunar and seasonal patterns. We get into that. So anybody interested in that stuff, you can go check it out at thehealingresponse.com. It's Michael Lowe, who's our guest next week. Again, Tom Vanderbilt's book, Traffic, great book, out in paperback. It's called, and you go to tomvanderbilt.com, more about that. And one big announcement I want to make, because if you're listening to the show even live or during the day on Thursday, on your way to work, if you're going home, if you drive your trucker heading east, tomorrow night here at Soma Space, I'm going to get the horn out. Hey. We're going to be having our first live in Larchmont Touchstar Talk with Amos Dordas. All right, naturopath extraordinaire. He's going to be talking coffee. So head over to somaspace.org/lil.html. That's somaspace.org/lil.html. Let's give a little presentation called Healthy Coffee, the Business and Benefits, 7:30 to 9 tomorrow night here at Soma Space in Larchmont, New York. Okay, you missed that address, you're too lazy, email me. All right, I'll get you back pretty quick at nakedsoma@gmail.com. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at SomaBoy. All add that there. So there you go. That's a lot of stuff. I know we covered pretty much everything I wanted to. And without having a live guest and experimented with the chat room tonight, got a lot of guests this month coming up in September that's going to be wowing you. We got authors coming on left and right. All right, so after next week, we've got Michael Lowe talking about the healing response. Week after that, we got Sam Gosling from Texas talking about personality psychology and getting into some of the stuff we're going to be talking about this fall with our Project Brain Flocker. And, you know, then, oh, big guest, September 23rd, as we have the Gary V Show coming on from WineLibrary.tv. Oh, I hope we get some listeners that night. You know, so we got, like I said, got lots of things lined up this month, and we're doing some stuff here over at Summer Space to make things more accessible to you, revamping always on summerspace.org. And I hope, like I said, I hope you enjoyed the interview tonight with Tom. Great book. I know we did it kind of underwater on the Skype. Hate the Skype. Hate the sign. And the best we could. And like I said, if you want, and if I want, and if we both hook up in the etheric plane later, we will get this thing posted for you, both here on the Blog Talk Radio platform and over at blogsummit.net, the blog we love, where all the previews are found for the shows, and you can just get everything kind of up to date, little capsule summaries that we post there on Sunday nights, the preview thing, so you can spread the Soma for me over there. Again, like I said, I got lots of stuff that you guys don't even dig at that you could in between shows, all right? So we'll see you next week after Labor Day, long weekend. Drive safe, be safe. Remember, the drunk driving laws are completely, completely out of whack, and they're enforcing them. There'll be those stupid little pullover things this weekend, so just know what you're up against. You're up against a bureaucracy as thick as a freaking brick wall, and it's out to get you. Out to get you. Makers of H1N1 coming at you with a vaccine soon. Same people out there trying to keep you off the roads driving drunk. I don't know. I think they've got it through. We talked about it on the show. Meanwhile, you're texting while you're driving, you get a $25 summons, and you could be, you know, wrapping yourself around a pole. Wow. I think I've exhausted myself on the whole human condition tonight. You know, I think I really have. Let's hit it, and we will play ourselves out here, if we haven't already. Warm myself out. Get the asleep at the wheel up again. There they are. Hey, all right. All right, guys, so thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Oh, come on. I can't get a break. Anyone have any questions again? NakedSoma@gmail.com. This is Dr. Mark wishing you very, very happy, restful, safe Labor Day weekend. See you back here on the 9th. Travel light. To the darkness.